in or out of the office. It was greeted by most in the unit as a waste of time. The whip usually knew where everyone was, and the lieutenant would as well if she ever came out of her office, or at least opened the blinds.
Sure, Bosch said.
Chu was back in the cubicle when Bosch returned.
Where were you? He asked.
In with the lieutenant. Where were you?
I went across the street. I never got breakfast. Chu changed the subject, pointing to a document that was on his computer screen.
Did you read Crate and Barrel's report on the canvas?
Not yet.
They found a guy who saw somebody on the fire escape. The timing's off, but man, what are the chances? Bosch turned back to his desk and found the printout of the report on the hillside canvas. It was essentially a list of consecutive addresses on Marmont Lane. After each address, it said whether the door was answered and a resident interviewed. They used abbreviations Bosch had read in LAPD canvas reports for more than 2 decades. There were a lot of NBHs, meaning nobody home, and a lot of DSATs, meaning the residents didn't see a thing, but one entry was several sentences long. Resident Earl Mitchell, WMDOB 41361, had insomnia and went to the kitchen to get a bottle of water. The residence's rear windows face rear and side of Chateau Marmont head-on. Resident said he noticed a man descending the fire escape ladder. Resident went to telescope in living room and looked at the hotel. The man on the fire escape was no longer in view. Resident did not call PD. Resident stated that this sighting occurred at approximately 12:40 a.m., which was the time on the bedroom clock when he decided to get up to get water. To the best of his memory, resident believes the figure on the fire escape was between the 5th and 6th floor and descending when seen. Bosch didn't know whether it was Crate or Barrel who had written the report. Whoever it was, he had employed short sentences in a staccato fashion, but he was no Hemingway. He had simply employed the policeman's KISS rule. Keep it simple, Sherlock. The fewer words in a report meant the fewer chances and angles of attack from critics and lawyers. Bosch pulled his phone and called Jerry Solomon. When Solomon answered, it sounded like he was in a car with the windows open.
It's Bosch. I'm looking at your canvas report here and have a couple questions.
Can it wait 10 minutes? I'm in the car and I'm with people, civilians.
Is your partner with you or can I just call him?
No, he's here with me.
That's nice, you guys out for a late lunch.
Look, Bosch, we haven't...
One of you call me as soon as you get back to the squad.
Harry closed the phone and focused his attention on the second report. This one dealt with the questioning of hotel guests and was set up in the same fashion as the other, only with room numbers instead of addresses. Again, there were lots of NBHs and DSATs. They did, however, manage to interview the man who checked into the hotel right after Irving. Thomas Rapport, WM 72156, NYC resident, arrived at the hotel from the airport at 9:40 p.m. Remember seeing George Irving at check-in. They did not speak to each other, and Rapport never saw Irving again. Rapport is a writer in town for script conferences at Archway Studios. Confirmed. Another completely incomplete report. Bosch checked his watch. It had been 20 minutes since Solomon said he needed 10 minutes. Harry opened his phone and called him back.
I thought you were supposed to call me in 10 minutes, he said by way of greeting.
I thought you said you were calling me, Solomon countered in a phony, confused tone.
Bosch closed his eyes for a moment and let the frustration pass. It wasn't worth getting into it with an old bull like Solomon.
I have questions about the reports you sent me.
Ask away. You're the boss.
As the conversation continued, Bosch opened a drawer and took out a three-hole punch. He started punching holes into the reports he had printed and sliding them into the prongs of the blue binder. There was something calming about putting the murder book together while dealing with Solomon. Okay, first of all, on this guy Mitchell, who saw the man on the fire escape, did he give a good reason why the guy just disappeared? I mean, he sees him between the fifth and sixth floors, and then when he goes to the telescope, the guy is gone. What happened to floors 1 through 4?
That's simple. He said by the time he swung the scope around and got it in focus, the guy was gone. He could have gone all the way down, or he could have gone inside on one of the landings.
Bosch almost asked him why that wasn't in the report, but he knew why, just as he knew that George Irving's death would have been written off as a suicide with crate and barrel in charge.
How do we know it wasn't Irving? Bosch asked. It was a curveball, and it took Solomon a moment to respond.
I guess we don't. But what would Irving be doing out there on the ladder?
I don't know.
Was there any description? Clothes, hair, race? He was too far away to be sure about any of that. He thought it was a white guy, and his impression was that it might have been a maintenance man. You know, working for the hotel.
At midnight? What made him think that?
He said his pants and shirt matched color, you know, like a uniform.
What color?
Light gray.
Did you check the hotel?
Check what at the hotel?
That false tone of confusion was back in his voice. Come on, Solomon, drop the stupid act. Did you check if there was any reason for someone in the hotel or working in the hotel to be on that fire escape? Did you ask him what color uniform their maintenance men wear?
No, I didn't, Bosch. There was no need to. The guy was going down the fire escape a good 2 to 4 hours before our guy took the high dive. They are unrelated matters. You sending us up that street was a complete waste of our time. That was what was stupid.
Bosch knew that if he lost his temper with Solomon, the detective would be completely useless for the rest of the investigation. He wasn't ready to lose him yet. Once again, he moved on. Okay, on the other report, your interview with this writer, Thomas Rapport. Why is he in L.A.?
I don't know. He's some kind of a big screenwriter. The studio put him up in one of those bungalows in the back where Belushi died. That's $2,000 a night, and he said he was in town for the whole week.
At least that answered one question before Bosch had to ask it. How long would they have local access to Rapport if they needed him? So, did the studio pop for a limo? How'd he get to the hotel?
No. He took a cab in from the airport. His plane landed early, and the studio car wasn't there yet, so he grabbed a cab. He said that's why Irving got in front of him at the check-in. They arrived at the same time, but Rapport had to wait for the cab driver to print out a receipt, and it took forever. He was sort of pissed about that. He was on East Coast time and dead tired. He wanted to get into his bungalow.
Bosch felt a brief stirring in his gut. It was a mixture of instinct and knowing that there was an order of things in the world. The truth was revealed to the righteous. He often felt it at the moment things started to tumble together on a case.
Jerry, he said, did Rapport tell you which cab company brought him to the hotel?
You mean what kind?
Yeah, you know, Valley Cab, Yellow Cab, which company? It says it on the door of the taxi.
He didn't say, but what's that got to do with anything?
Maybe nothing. Did you get a cell phone for this guy?
No, but he's there at the hotel for a week.
Right, I got that. I tell you what, Jerry, I want you and your partner to go back over to the hotel and ask about the man on the fire escape. Find out if they had anybody working that night who could have been the man on the ladder. And find out about the uniforms they wear.
Come on, Bosch. It was at least 2 hours before Irving went down, most likely longer.
I don't care if it was 2 days. I want you out there asking the questions. Send me the report
when you're done. By tonight. Bosch closed the phone. He turned and looked at Chu. Let me see the file on Irving's taxi franchise client. Chu looked through the stack of files and handed one to Bosch.
What's going on? Chu asked.
Nothing yet. What are you working on?
The insurance. So far it's all legit. But I have to make a call.
Me too. Bosch picked up his desk phone and called the Chateau Marmont. He was in luck. When he was transferred to Thomas Rapport's bungalow, the writer answered.
Mr. Rapport, this is Detective Bosch with the LAPD. I have a few follow-up questions regarding the interview you gave my colleagues earlier. Would this be a good time to talk?
Not really. I'm in the middle of a scene right at the moment.
A scene?
A movie scene. I'm writing a movie scene.
I see, and I understand, but this will only take a few minutes of your time, and this is very important to the investigation.
Did the guy jump, or was he pushed?
We can't say for sure, sir, but if you answer a couple questions, we will be closer to knowing.
Go ahead, detective, I'm all yours. From your voice, I'm picturing you as sort of a Columbo-looking guy.
That's fine, sir. Can I start?
Yes, detective.
You arrived at the hotel on Sunday evening by taxi, is that correct?
Yes, it is, direct from LAX. Archway was supposed to send a car, but I got in early and there was no car. I didn't want to wait, so I just took a cab.
Do you happen to remember the name of the cab company you used?
The company? You mean like Checker Cab or something?
Yes, sir. We have several companies that are licensed to operate in the city. I'm looking for the name that was on the door of your cab.
I'm sorry, I don't know it. There was just a line of taxis and I jumped in one.
You remember what color it was?
No, I just remember it was dirty inside. I should have waited for the studio car.
You told Detectives Solomon and Glanville that you were delayed a bit on your arrival at the hotel while you were waiting for the cab driver to print out a receipt. Do you have that receipt handy?
Hold on.
While Bosch waited, he opened the file for Irving's taxi franchise project and started looking through the documents. He found the contract Irving had signed with Regent 9 months earlier, then came to a letter that was addressed to the city's franchise board. It informed the board that Regent Taxi would be competing for the Hollywood franchise when it came up for renewal in the coming year. The letter also listed the performance and trust issues facing the current franchise holder, Black and White Taxi. Before Bosch finished reading the letter, Rapport came back on the phone.
I have it here, Detective. It was Black and White. That was the name of the company.
Thank you, Mr. Rapport. I have one last question. Does it say on the receipt who the driver was?
No. It just gives his number. It says driver 26. Does that help?
It does, sir. It helps a lot.
Now, that's a pretty nice place you're staying in, right?
Very nice. And I think you know who died here.
Yes, I do. But the reason I ask is, do you know if that room is equipped with a fax machine?
I don't have to look.
I know it is because I faxed pages to the set an hour ago.
You want me to fax you this receipt?
Exactly, sir.
Bosch gave him the number to the fax in the lieutenant's office. No one would be able to look at the receipt except Duval.
It will be on its way as soon as I hang up, Lieutenant, Rapport said.
That's Detective.
I keep forgetting you're not Columbo.
No, sir, I'm not. But I am going to hit you with another question.
Rapport laughed.
Go ahead.
It's a tight space in the garage area where you come in. Did your taxi pull in ahead of Mr. Irving's car? Or was it the other way around?
Other way, we pulled in right behind him.
So when Irving got out of his car, did you see him?
Yeah, he stood there and gave his keys to the valet guy, and they wrote his name on a receipt and gave him a copy. The usual thing.
Did your driver see this?
I don't know, but he had a better view through the windshield than I did in the back.
Thank you, Mr. Rapport. And good luck with the scene you're writing.
I hope I've helped.
You have.
Bosch hung up, and while he waited for the receipt to arrive via fax, he called George Irving's office manager, Dana Rosen, and asked her about the letter to the city's franchise board that was in the Regent taxi file.
Is this a copy or the original that was not yet sent out? He asked.
Oh, no, that was sent out. We sent it individually to every member of the board. That was the first step in announcing the plans to go for the Hollywood franchise.
Bosch was looking at the letter as they spoke. It was dated 2 Mondays earlier.
Was there any response to this? He asked.
Not yet. It would have been in the file if there was.
Thank you, Dana.
Bosch hung up and went back to looking through the Regent file. He found a paperclip batch of printouts that must have been the backup Irving used for the allegations contained in the letter. There was a copy of a story that had been in the Times and reported that the third black-and-white driver in 4 months had been arrested for driving drunk while operating a taxi. The story also reported that a BMW driver was determined to have been at fault in an accident involving serious injuries to the couple in the cab's back seat earlier in the year. The stack also contained copies of the arrest reports on the DUI stops and a batch of moving violations that had been written against BMW drivers. Everything from running red lights to double parking, the moving violations were probably just routine and collateral to the DUI arrests. The records made it easy for Bosch to see why Irving thought BMW was vulnerable. Snatching the Hollywood franchise was probably going to be the easiest piece of business he had ever done. Bosch quickly scanned the arrest reports, but was snagged by a curiosity. He noticed that in each of the reports, the same badge number had been entered in the block identifying the arresting officer. 3 arrests spread over 4 months. It seemed beyond coincidence that the same cop would have made all 3 arrests. He knew that it was conceivable that the badge number simply belonged to the jail officer who had administered the breathalyzer tests at Hollywood Division after the cab drivers were taken into custody by other officers. But even that would have been unusual and out of procedure. He picked up the phone and called the department's personnel office. He gave his own name and badge number and said he needed to get an ID off a badge. He was transferred to a mid-level bureaucrat who looked it up on the computer and gave Bosch the name, rank, and assignment.
Robert Mason, P3, Hollywood.
As in Bobby Mason, George Irving's longtime friend, until recently.
Bosch thanked her and hung up. He wrote down the information he had just assembled and then studied it. He didn't believe in coincidences. Therefore, he could not dismiss, as happenstance, the fact that Mason had made 3 DUI arrests of BMW drivers at a time he was apparently still friends with a man representing a rival to BMW's Hollywood franchise. He circled Mason's name in his notes. The patrol officer was definitely someone Bosch wanted to talk to, but not yet. Bosch needed to know far more than he knew now before he could make the approach. He moved on and next studied the arrest summaries, which contained the probable cause for detaining the drivers. In each case, the driver had been observed driving erratically. In one of the cases, the summary noted that a half-empty bottle of Jack Daniel's bourbon had been found under the driver's seat of the taxi. Bosch noted that the report did not mention the size of the bottle, and for a moment he mused over the choice of the words half-empty over half-full, and the different interpretations the descriptions might bring. But then Chu rolled his chair over and leaned against his desk.
Harry, sounds like you've got something going.
Yeah, maybe. You want to take a ride?
Chapter 18.
Black and White Taxi was located in an old soundstage on Gower, south of Sunset. It was an industrial neighborhood full of businesses that catered to the movie industry. Costume warehouses, camera houses, prop houses. BMW was in one of the two side-by-side soundstages that looked old and worn out. The cab company operated out of one, and the other was a storage and rental facility for movie cars. Bosch had been in the car storage facility before, on a case. He had taken his time walking through. It was like a museum, with every car that had ever caught his eye as a teenager. The two hangar doors of B&W were wide open. Bosch and Chu walked in. In the moment of blindness when their eyes adjusted from the transition of sunlight to shadows, they were almost hit by a taxi heading out to the street. They jumped back and let the black and white checked Impala go between them. "Asshole!" Chu said. There were cars sitting dormant and cars up on jacks and being worked on by mechanics in greasy coveralls. At the far end of the large space, there were two picnic tables next to a couple of snack and beverage machines. A handful of drivers were hanging out there, waiting for their chariots to pass muster with the mechanics. To their right was a small office with glass windows that were so dirty they were opaque. But behind them, Harry could see shapes and movement. He led Chu that way. Bosch knocked once on the door and went in without waiting for a response. They stepped into an office with three desks pushed up against three of the walls and awash with paperwork. Two of them were occupied by men who had not turned to see who had entered. Both of them were wearing headsets. The man on the right was dispatching a car to a pickup at the Roosevelt Hotel. Bosch waited for him to finish. "Excuse me," he said. Both men turned to look at the intruders. Bosch was ready with his badge out. "I need to ask a couple questions."
"Well, we're running a business here, and don't—"
A phone rang, and the man on the left punched a button on his desk to activate his headset.
"Black and White?"
"Yes, ma'am. That will be 5 to 10 minutes. Would you like us to call upon arrival?"
He wrote something down on a yellow post-it, then tore it off the pad and handed it to the dispatcher so he could send a car to the address.
"Car's on the way, ma'am,"
he said, then punched the desk button to disconnect the call. He swiveled in his seat to face Bosch and Chu.
"You see," he said, "we don't have any time for your bullshit."
"What bullshit is that?"
"I don't know. Whatever you're spinning today, we know what you're doing."
Another call came in, and the info was taken and moved to the dispatcher. Bosch stepped into the space between the two desks. If the call taker wanted to pass on a post-it to the dispatcher now, he'd have to go through Bosch.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Bosch said.
"Good, then, neither do I," the call taker said. "We can just never mind this whole thing. Have a good day."
"Except I still need to ask a couple questions."
The phone buzzed again, but this time when the man reached for the desk button, Bosch was quicker. He pushed it once to connect the call, then again to disconnect it.
"What the fuck you doing, man? This is our business here."
"It's my business being here, too. They'll just call somebody else. Maybe Regent Cab will get their business."
Bosch checked him for a reaction and saw his tight-lipped response.
"Now, who is driver 26? "We don't give drivers numbers. We give cars numbers."
His tone was meant to convey that he thought this was the dumbest pair of cops going.
"Then tell me, who was driving car 26 about 8 o'clock Sunday night?"
The call taker leaned back so he could look around Bosch at the dispatcher, and they exchanged a silent message.
"You got a warrant for that?" the dispatcher asked. "We're just not going to give you a guy's name so you can go out and trump up another bullshit arrest on us."
"I don't need a warrant," Bosch said.
"The hell you don't," cried the dispatcher.
"What I need is your cooperation, and if I don't get it, those juices you're worried about are going to be the least of your problems. And at the end of the day, I'm still going to get what I want. So decide right now how you want to play it."
The two B&W men looked at each other again. Bosch looked at Chu. If the bluff didn't work, they might have to amp up the situation. Bosch checked Chu's face for any sign of retreat. There was none. The dispatcher opened a binder that was to the side of his desk. From Bosch's angle, he could see it was some sort of schedule. He turned back two pages to Sunday. All right, Hooch Rawlins had that car Sunday night. Now leave, the both of you.
Hooch Rawlins?
What's his real name? How the fuck should we know?
It was the dispatcher.
Bosch was getting pretty annoyed with him. He stepped over closer and looked down at him. The phone rang.
Don't answer that, Bosch said.
You're killing us here, man.
They'll call back.
Bosch locked in on the dispatcher. Is Hooch Rawlins working right now?
Yeah, he's working a double today.
Well, dispatcher, get on the radio and call him back here.
Yeah, what do I say to get him to do that?
You tell him you need to switch out his car. Tell him you've got a better one for him. It just came in on the truck.
He won't believe that. We got no truck coming. We're about to go out of business, thanks to you people.
Make him believe it. Bosch gave the dispatcher a hard look, and the man turned to his microphone and called Hooch Rawlins in. Bosch and Chu stepped out of the office and conferred about what to do when Rawlins showed up. They decided that they would wait until he was out of the car before making an approach to him. A few minutes later, a beat-up taxi that was a year past needing a wash pulled into the Bay Area. It was driven by a man in a straw hat. He jumped out and said to no one in particular, "Where's my new wheels?" Bosch and Chu approached from two sides. When they got close enough to contain Rawlins, Bosch spoke.
"Mr. Rawlins, we're with the LAPD, and we need to ask you some questions."
Rawlins looked confused. Then the fight-or-flight look entered his eyes.
"What?"
"I said we need to ask you a few questions."
Bosch badged him then, so that he would know that it was formal and official. There was no running from the law.
"What'd I do?"
"As far as we know, nothing, Mr. Rawlins. We want to talk to you about something you may have seen."
"You're not going to jack me up like the other fellas, are you?"
"We don't know anything about that. Would you please accompany us to the Hollywood police station so we can sit in a quiet room and talk?"
"Am I under arrest?"
"Not now, no. We were counting on you wanting to cooperate and just answer some questions. We'll get you back here right after."
"Man, if I'm with you, then I ain't making no money out there."
Bosch was about to lose his patience. "We won't take long, Mr. Rawlins. Please cooperate with us." Rawlins seemed to read Bosch's tone and realized that it didn't matter whether he went the hard or easy way, but that he was going nonetheless. The street pragmatist in him made him choose the easy way.
"Okay, let's get it over with. You don't have to cuff me or anything, do you?"
"No cuffs," Bosch said. "Just nice and easy." On the way, Chu sat in the back with the uncuffed Rawlins, and Bosch called ahead to the nearby Hollywood division and reserved an interrogation room in the detective bureau. It was a 5-minute ride over, and soon they were walking Rawlins into a 9x9 with a table and three chairs. Bosch made him sit on the side with only one chair.
"Can we get you something before we start?" Bosch asked.
"How about a Coke, a smoke, and a poke?"
He started to laugh. The detectives didn't.
"How about just a Coke?" Bosch said.
Bosch reached into his pocket for his change and then picked four quarters off his palm. He handed them to Chu. Chu was the junior partner here. He would go out to the machines in the back hallway.
"So, Hooch, why don't we start with you telling me your real full name?"
"Richard Alvin Rawlins."
"How did you get that name, Hooch?"
"I don't know, man. I just always had it."
"What did you mean back at the shop when you said you didn't want to get jacked like the other fellows?"
"That was nothing, man."
"Sure it was. You said it.
So tell me who's getting jacked up. Jacked up by cops? You tell me, and it doesn't leave this room."
"Ah, man, you know.
It just looks to us like they're coming after us all of a sudden with the DUIs and everything.
And you think those were setups?
Come on, man, it's politics. What do you expect? I mean, look at what they did to that Armenian bastard.
Bosch remembered one of the drivers arrested was named Ratch Tartarian. He assumed Rollins was referring to him.
What about him?
He was just sitting on the stand, and they pull up and pull him out of the car. He refuses to blow, but then they find the bottle under the seat, and he's toast. That bottle, man, is always under there. It stays in that car, and nobody be driving drunk. You take a couple of sips a night to make yourself right. But everybody wants to know how those officers knew about that bottle, you know?
Bosch sat back in his chair and tried to follow and decipher what had been said. Chu came back in and put a can of Coke down in front of Rollins. He then took a seat at the corner of the table and to Bosch's right.
This conspiracy to set you guys up, who's behind it? Who's running it?
Rollins raised his hands in a gesture meant to say, isn't it obvious?
It's the councilman, and he just lets his son do the dirty work and run things. I mean, he did. Now he's dead.
How do you know that?
I seen it in the paper. Everybody knows that.
Did you ever see the son before? In person?
Rollins didn't speak for a long moment. His mind was probably working, dancing around the trap being set for him. He decided not to lie.
For like 10 seconds, I was on a drop Sunday at the chateau and saw him there going in. That was it.
Bosch nodded.
How did you know who he was?
Because I seen a picture of him.
Where, the newspaper?
No, somebody had a picture of him after we got the letter.
What letter?
B&W, man, we got a copy of a letter from the Irving guy telling the city people that they were coming after our ticket. They were going to shut us down. Somebody Googled the motherfucker in the office. They got his picture and showed it around. It was on the bulletin board with the letter. They wanted us drivers to know what was up and what was at stake, that this guy was leading the charge against us, and we better shape up and fly straight.
Bosch understood the strategy.
So you recognized him when you pulled into the Chateau Marmont on Sunday night?
Damn right. I knew he was the asshole trying to run us out of business.
Have some Coke.
Bosch needed to break momentum to think about this. While Rollins opened the can and started to drink, Harry thought of the next set of questions. There were a number of things going on here that he had not seen coming. Rollins took a long drink and put the can down.
When did you get off shift Sunday night? Bosch asked.
I didn't. I need doubles on account of my girl about to drop a kid without no insurance. I took a second shift just like I'm doing today and worked on through to the light of day. That'd be Monday.
What were you wearing that night?
What is this shit, man? You said I'm not a suspect.
You're not as long as you keep answering questions. What were you wearing, Hooch?
My usual thing, Tommy Bahama and my cargoes. You sit in a car 16 hours and you want to be comfortable.
What color was the shirt?
He gestured to his chest.
This is the shirt.
It was bright yellow with a surfboard design on it. Bosch was pretty sure of one thing. It was a Tommy Bahama knockoff, not the real thing. Either way, it seemed to him to be a stretch to consider the shirt gray. Unless Rollins had changed clothes, he wasn't the man on the fire escape ladder.
So who did you tell that you had seen Irving at the hotel? Bosch asked.
No one.
Are you sure about that, Hooch? You don't want to start lying to us. That would make it tough for us to let you go.
Nobody, man.
Bosch could tell by the sudden lack of eye contact that Rollins was lying.
That's too bad, Hooch. I figured you were smart enough to know we wouldn't ask a question we didn't already know the answer to.
Bosch stood up. He reached under his jacket and pulled his handcuffs off his belt.
I only told my shift supervisor, Rollins said quickly.
Just like in passing, on the radio. I said, guess who I just saw, like that.
Yeah.
And did he guess it was Irving?
No, I had to tell him. But that was it.
Did your shift supervisor ask where you just saw Irving?
No, he knew because I had called in my 20 on the drop-off. He knew where I was.
What else did you tell him?
That was it. Just that. Like conversation.
Bosch paused to see if anything else would come out.
Rollins was silent, his eyes holding on the cuffs in Bosch's hand.
Okay, Hooch, what's the name of the shift supervisor you had Sunday night?
Mark McQuillan. He's on the stick at night.
The stick?
He's the dispatcher. But they call him the stick because in the old days there was like a microphone or something on the desk. The stick. You know, somebody told me he's an ex-cop.
Bosch looked at Rollins for a long moment as he fit the name McQuillan into the picture. Rollins was right about his being an ex-cop, and the feeling Bosch had earlier about things tumbling together now returned. Only things weren't tumbling anymore, they were cascading. Mark McQuillan was a name out of the past, both Bosch's and the department's. Bosch finally came away from his thoughts and looked at Rollins. What did McQuillan say when you told him you saw Irving?
Nothing. I think he asked if the guy was checking in.
And what did you tell him?
That I thought he was. I mean, he was dumping his car at the garage. That garage is too small. They only let hotel guests park there. If you're just going to the bar or something, you have to use the outside valet.
Bosch nodded. Rollins was right about that. Okay, we're going to take you back now, Hooch. If you tell anybody what we talked about here, I'm going to know. And I promise you, if that happens, it's not going to turn out good for you. Rollins raised his hands in surrender.
I'm straight with that, he said.
Chapter 19. After they dropped Rollins off, they headed back toward downtown and the PAB.
So McQuillan, Chu said, as Bosch knew he would. Who is he? I could tell the name meant something to you.
Like Hooch said, a former cop. But you know him, or knew him.
I knew of him. I never met him.
Well, what's the story?
He was a cop who was sacrificed to the gods of appeasement. He lost his job for doing it just the way they taught him.
Stop talking in circles, Harry. What's going on?
What's going on is that I have to go up to the 10th floor and talk to somebody.
The chief?
No, not the chief.
And this is one of those times again where you're not going to tell your partner what's going on until you feel like it?
Bosch didn't answer. He was grinding things down.
Harry, I'm talking to you.
Chu, when we get back, I want you to start a moniker search.
Who?
Somebody who went by the name Chill in the North Hollywood Burbank area 20 years ago.
What the fuck? Are you talking about the other case now?
I want you to find this guy. His initials are C.H., and people called him Chill. It's got to be a variation on his first name. Chu shook his head.
That's it, man. I'm done after this. I can't work this way. I'll tell the lieutenant.
Bosch just nodded. After this. Does that mean you'll do the moniker search first? Bosch didn't call ahead to Kiz Rider. He just took the elevator up to the 10th floor and entered the OCP suite without invitation or appointment. He was met by twin desks with twin adjutants behind them. He went to his left.
Detective Harry Bosch, I need to see Lieutenant Ryder.
The adjutant was a young officer in a crisp uniform with the name Rivera on his nameplate. He picked up a clipboard from the side of his desk and studied it for a moment.
I don't have anything here. Is the lieutenant expecting you? She's in a meeting.
Yes. Rivera seemed surprised by the answer. He had to check the clipboard again.
Why don't you have a seat, detective, and I'll check on availability.
You do that. Rivera didn't move. He waited for Bosch to go away. Harry walked over to some chairs arranged near a set of windows that looked out upon the Civic Center. The signature spire of City Hall took up most of the view.
He stayed standing. When Harry was a safe distance from the desk, Rivera picked up his phone and made a call, cupping his hand over the mouthpiece when he spoke to someone on the other end. Soon he hung up, but did not even glance in Bosch's direction. Bosch turned back to the window and looked down. He saw a television camera crew set up on the steps of City Hall, waiting for a soundbite from some politician with something to sell. Bosch wondered if it would be Irving who would come out and descend the marble steps.
Harry?
He turned. It was Ryder.
Walk with me.
He wished she hadn't said that line, but he followed when she turned and walked out the double doors to the hallway. Once they were alone, she turned on him.
What's going on? I have people in my office.
We need to talk now.
So talk.
No, not here like this. Things are breaking. It's going the way I warned you. The chief should know. Who's in your office? Is it Irving?
No. Stop being paranoid.
Then why are we talking out here?
Because the office is busy and because it was you who demanded complete confidentiality on this. Give me 10 minutes and meet me by Charlie Chaplin.
Bosch walked over and pushed the elevator button. There was only a down button. I'll be there. It was a block's walk to the Bradbury building. Bosch went in the side door on 3rd and into the dimly lit stairwell vestibule. There was a bench there, and standing next to it was a sculpture of Charlie Chaplin as his signature character, the Tramp. Bosch took a seat in the shadows next to Charlie and waited. The Bradbury was the oldest and most beautiful building in downtown. It housed private offices as well as LAPD offices, including the Board of Rights hearing rooms used by Internal Affairs. It was an odd choice for a surreptitious meeting, but it was the spot Bosch and Ryder had used in the past. No discussion or direction was needed once Kiss had said, "Meet me at Charlie Chaplin." Ryder was almost 10 minutes past the first 10 minutes, but that was okay with Bosch. He had used the time to construct the story he would tell her. It was complicated and still emerging, even improvisational. He had just finished walking himself through it when he felt the buzz of an incoming text on his phone. He pulled it from his pocket, half expecting the message to be a cancellation of the meeting from Ryder, but it was from his daughter.
"Dad, having dinner and study hall at Ashes. Her mom makes good pizza. Kay?"
He felt a slight pang of guilt because he welcomed the message. With his daughter taken care of for the evening, he had more time to work his cases. It also meant that he could see Hannah Stone again if he could come up with a viable investigative reason. He sent back his approval, but told his daughter she had to be home by 10. He told her to call if she needed a ride. Bosch was pocketing his phone when Ryder came in, hesitated a moment while her eyes adjusted to the shadows, and then sat down next to him.
"Hi," she said.
"Hi," he said. He waited a moment for her to settle, but she wasn't interested in wasting time.
"Well?"
"You ready?"
"Of course, I'm here. Tell me the story."
"Well, it goes like this. George Irving has a consulting firm that is really an influence firm. He sells his influence, his connection to his father, and the faction his father is part of on the city council. He..."
"Do you have documentary evidence of this?"
"Right now, it's just a story, Kiz, and it's just you and me here. Let me tell it, and then you can ask your questions when I'm done."
"Go ahead, then."
The door on 3rd opened, and a uniformed officer walked in, took off his sunglasses and looked around, blindly at first, then focusing on Bosch and Ryder, and correctly sizing them up as cops.
"Is this where the BORs are heard?"
he asked.
"3rd floor," Ryder said.
"Thank you."
"Good luck."
"Yeah."
Bosch waited until the cop left the vestibule and rounded the corner into the main lobby where the elevators were located. "Okay, so George sells influence with the council, and by extension, all the different boards the council appoints. In some cases, he can do even more than that. He can tilt the game."
"I don't get it. How so?"
Do you know how taxi franchises are awarded in this city?
Not a clue.
By geographic zones and on 2-year contracts. You come up for review every 2 years.
All right.
So I don't know if George goes to them or they come to George, but there's a franchise holder in South L.A. called Regent Taxi, and they hire George to help them get a more lucrative franchise up in Hollywood, where there are Highline hotels and tourists on the streets and lots more money to be made. The current franchise holder is Black and White Taxi.
I think I know where this is going, but wouldn't Councilman Irving have to be transparent on this? He'd have a conflict of interest voting for any company repped by his son.
Of course he would. But the first vote is with the taxi franchise board. And who puts the people on that board?
The council.
And when it next comes before the council for ratification, sure, Irving nobly cites conflict of interest and steps out on the vote, and it all looks completely above board.
But what about the backroom trade-offs?
You vote for me when I step out, and next time I'll vote for you. You know what goes on, kids. But what George offers is even more of a sure thing. He offers a fuller service, shall we say. Regent says, yes, we'll take the full package, and a month after he's hired by Regent, things start going sideways for the current holder of the franchise, B&W.
What do you mean, sideways?
I'm trying to tell you. Less than a month after George Irving is hired by Regent, B&W drivers start getting popped on deuce wraps and traffic citations, and suddenly the company's not looking so good.
How many arrests?
3. The first coming a month after Irving signed on. And then there's an auto accident where the B&W driver is held at fault. There are several traffic violations, all moving violations, that give the appearance of reckless driving, speeding, running traffic lights, and stop signs.
I think the Times wrote about this. The DUIs, anyway.
Yeah, I have the story, and I'm pretty sure George Irving's the one who tipped them to it. It was all part of an organized plan to get the Hollywood taxi franchise.
So you're saying that the son went to the father and said put some pressure on B&W?
The father then, in turn, reached into the department? I'm not exactly sure how it worked yet, but both of them, father and son, still have connections in the department. The councilman has sympathizers, and his son was a cop for 5 years. Until recently, a close friend of his worked patrol in Hollywood. I have all the B&W arrest reports and the traffic citations. The same cop, George Irving's friend, made all 3 DUI arrests and wrote 2 of the moving violations. A guy named Robert Mason. What are the chances of that? That he'd get all 3 deuces?
It could happen. You make 1 arrest, and then you know what to look for after that.
Sure, kids, whatever you say. One of these guys wasn't even pulled over. He was parked at a cab stand on La Brea when Mason rolled up on him.
Well, were these legit busts or not?
Did they blow?
They blew, and the busts were legit as far as I know. But 3 busts starting a month after Irving was hired. The DUIs, the moving violations, and the accident report then become the centerpiece of Regent's application to the franchise board to take Hollywood away from B&W. He had it completely greased, and it just doesn't smell right, kids.
She finally nodded, a tacit agreement with Bosch's point of view.
Okay, even if I agree with you, there's still the question. How does all of this get George Irving killed? And why?
I'm not sure why, but let me move to the...
Bosch stopped when there was a loud explosion of voices from the lobby. After a few seconds, they were gone.
Okay, let me move to the night Irving took the high dive. He arrives by car at 9:40, gives his keys to the valet, and goes upstairs to the lobby to check in. Also arriving at that time is a writer from the East Coast named Thomas Rapport. He comes by cab from the airport and pulls in right behind Irving.
Don't tell me he was in a black and white cab.
You know, Lieutenant, you really ought to be a detective.
I tried it.
but my partner was an asshole.
I heard about that.
Anyway, yes, it was a B&W cab, and the driver actually recognized Irving as he was turning his car over to the valet. His picture had been shown around the garage when the application letter to the franchise board got copied to B&W. This driver, a guy named Rollins, recognizes Irving and gets on his radio and says, "What do you know? I just saw Public Enemy Number One," or words to that effect. And on the other end of that radio call is the shift supervisor, the night man, a guy named Mark McQuillan. Bosch stopped there and waited for her to recognize the name. She didn't. "McQuillan as in McKillen," he said. "That ring a bell?" It still didn't break through. Ryder shook her head. "Before your time," Bosch said. "Who is he?" "A former cop, maybe 10 years younger than me. Back in the day, he became the poster boy for the whole chokehold thing, the controversy. And he got sacrificed to the mob."
"I don't understand, Harry. What mob? What sacrifice?"
"I told you I was on the task force. The task force was formed to appease the citizenry of South L.A., who claimed that the chokehold was legalized murder. Cops used it, and an inordinate number of people in the South End died. The truth was, they didn't need a task force to change policy. They could have just changed it. But instead, they go with a task force so they could feed the media the story about how the department was serious in its effort to respond to the public outcry."
"All right, so how does this lead to McQuillan?"
"I was just a grunt on the task force, a gatherer. I handled the autopsies. I know this, though. The statistics matched up across racial and geographic lines. Sure, there were more chokehold deaths in the South End. Far more African Americans died than other races. But the ratios were even. There were far more incidents involving use of force in the South End. The more confrontations, scuffles, fights, resisting arrests you get, the more uses of the chokehold. The more you use the chokehold, the more deaths you will have. It was simple math. But nothing is simple when racial politics are involved." Ryder was black and had grown up in South L.A., but Bosch was speaking to her cop to cop, and there was no awkwardness in his telling the story. They had been partners and had operated as a team under extreme pressures. Ryder knew Bosch as well as anyone could. They were brother and sister, and there was no holdback between them. "McQuillan worked PM watch in 77th, he said. "He liked action, and he got it almost every night. I don't remember the exact number, but he'd had something like 60-plus use-of-force incidents in 4 years. And as you know, those are only the ones they write reports on. In those incidents, he used the chokehold a lot, and he ended up killing 2 people in a 3-year span. Of all the chokehold deaths over all the years, there was nobody involved in more than one. Only him, because he had used it more than anybody else. So when the task force came along, he got special attention."
"Right.
Now, every one of his use-of-force incidents came back clean on review at the time of occurrence, including the 2 deaths. It was determined by a review board that both times he used the hold within policy. But one time, and it's an unlucky thing. 2 times, and there's a pattern. Somebody leaked his name and history to the Times, which was hovering over the task force like the smog over downtown. They ran a story, and McQuillan became the poster boy for what was wrong in the department. Didn't matter that he had never been found to have acted out of policy. He was the guy, a killer cop. The head of the Minister's Coalition at the time held a press conference, it seemed, every other day. He started calling him McKillen, and it stuck. Bosch got up from the bench so he could pace a little bit as he continued. "The task force recommended that the bar hold be dropped from the use of force progression, and it was. Funny thing is, the department then told officers to rely more on their batons. In fact, you could be disciplined if you got out of a patrol car without carrying your baton in your hand or on your belt. Added to that, tasers were coming into use just as the chokehold went out. And what did we get? Rodney King. A video that changed the world. A video of a guy being tased and wailed on with batons when a proper chokehold would have just put him to sleep.
Huh, Ryder said. I never looked at it that way.
Bosch nodded. Anyway, dropping the chokehold wasn't enough. There had to be an offering to the angry mob, and it was McQuillan. He was suspended on what I always thought were trumped-up, politically motivated charges. The review of the deaths determined that in the second case, he had been out of policy in the escalation of the use of force sequence. In other words, the chokehold that killed the guy was okay, but everything he did up until he used it was wrong. He was brought up on a board of rights and fired. The case was referred to the DA, and the DA took a pass. At the time, I remember thinking McQuillan was lucky they didn't ride the wave and prosecute him. He sued to get his job back, but that was a non-starter. He was done. Bosch ended it there for the moment to see if Ryder had a response. She had folded her arms across her chest and was staring into the shadows. Bosch knew she was grinding it down, seeing how all of this played out in the present.
So, she finally said, 25 years ago, a task force headed by Irvin Irving results in McQuillan losing his job and career in a process that, at least in his view, was unfounded and unfair. Now we have what appears as an attempt by Irving's son and possibly the councilman himself to grab the franchise from the business where McQuillan now works as, what, a night dispatcher?
Shift supervisor, which I guess really means dispatcher.
And this adds up to him murdering George Irving. I can connect the dots, but I'm having trouble with the motive, Harry.
Well, we don't know anything about McQuillan, do we? We don't know if he's been carrying this grudge around like a festering wound, and the opportunity simply presented itself. A driver calls in and says, "Guess who I just saw?" We have the abrasion pattern on the shoulder. It's unmistakable evidence of the chokehold. We also have a witness who saw somebody on the fire escape.
What witness? You didn't tell me you had a witness.
I just found out today. The hillside behind the hotel was canvassed, and they came up with a resident who saw a man on the fire escape ladder Sunday night. But he says it was 12:40 a.m., and the coroner puts TOD no earlier than 2 and as late as 4. So we have almost a 2-hour discrepancy. The guy on the ladder was going down at 12:40, not up. There is this, though. The witness described the guy on the ladder as wearing some sort of uniform, gray top and gray pants. I was in B&W's taxi barn today. It's where the dispatch office is. The mechanics who work on the fleet wear gray coveralls. McQuillan could have put on coveralls before going up the ladder. Bosch flipped his hands out at his sides as if to say that was it. That was all he had. Ryder was silent for a long moment before asking what Bosch knew she would ask. "You always taught me to ask where the holes were. Look at your case and find the holes, because if you don't find them, a defense attorney will do it for you. So, Harry, where are the holes?" Bosch shrugged. "The time discrepancy is a hole, and we don't have anything that would put McQuillan in Irving's room. All prints found in there and on the fire escape ladder were run through the computer.